Good morning. Can I just clarify something, just to make me feel better more than anything? We have all got a cupboard in the kitchen that is one of those cupboards. Perhaps it's for you, it's a drawer, where no matter how tidy you leave it, when it goes back, you still can't find anything that you put in there. And it's like, it's normally like the Tupperware cupboard or something like that. I have that, and I'm sure there's not many nods, but I can imagine there probably are. People are feeling a lot of guilt around that, I imagine, by not admitting that in their life. I would have thought today you need to, you know, redeem some of that. You all have a messy cupboard, let's face it. Anyway, so as Steve said, my name is Mike, and I'm a volunteer here at The Forge. I spend a bit of time over in our kids' congregation, where we get involved in a lot of mess. There, honestly, you should see the faces of kids' volunteers when on the plan you see things like glitter, paint, yes, thank you, amen, hammer beads. It's like, oh, no. Oh, not today. Why is it not next week when, like, Sarah's on? It's when I'm on. But as Steve said, we've been looking through this series, this Address the Mess series, and this is the conclusion of that series. But the one thing we've been looking at and bringing up time and time again is one thing that is kind of common to all of us is that at some point we will have found ourselves in a mess. We're either in a mess or we're about to probably stumble into a mess. To a greater or lesser degree in all of our lives, we will find ourselves in a mess. And because of that, I just want to be able to conclude this series today by sharing just kind of a simple idea and a simple question that will make sure that when you're in a mess, you don't make that mess messier. Because that can happen, can't it? You know, as I've been thinking about this Address the Mess series, as I've been thinking about mess getting messier, I started to think about parenting and how parenting is quite strange. Claire and I have, we have two teenage daughters. Yeah, that's why I look like this and I've got grey hair and I'm starting to lose it at the back. Claire and I are both very tidy people, I think. I think we like to keep the house clean and tidy and uncluttered and all of that. Claire, she really likes the house to be clean when we're on holiday. I still don't understand that one. But I do buy into this cleanliness thing. If you saw my desk at work or at home, it's everything's in its place. It's kind of clear and uncluttered. I think this is probably down to middle age as well. But I've got some sort of obsession with clearing the draining board. I don't know where that's come from, but if there's stuff there, I have to put it away, and it goes away. Mia, our youngest daughter, she's about to be 15. She's kind of the same. Her room is spotless. Everything has a place, and it's always in its place. And if she has a drink or something, she will take it to the sink, and she will wash it up. And you know what? If there's other people's stuff there, she will wash that up as well. It's like, she's a teenager. It's mind-blowing. It's absolutely mind-blowing. This is why parenting is strange, because Izzy, our eldest daughter, who's singing here this morning, is not like that at all. She really isn't. I don't know how we've failed as parents, but we have. No, perhaps not. But her room is a bomb site. Here's some evidence. I did seek her permission. Actually, you laugh. This is really good, because you can see the carpet. It's a miracle, praise the Lord, that we have a carpet. No, it's because she uses her floordrobe. She does have a wardrobe, but she uses a floordrobe instead. That's far easier. If Izzy has had a drink, and actually you know where she's had a drink, because the mug will be exactly where she finished drinking that drink, and there's just strewn across the house, and we'll find them wherever. And you know, we don't know what happened. Mia's turned out normal. And I don't know why she's like it, but she is. And you know what? I'll admit it, she's quite happy with it. She doesn't mind. She's not bothered by it. It's just the rest of us in the house. But no, she's totally cool with it. She will actually tidy her room after tons and tons and tons of reminding, and also the favourite weapon of every parent, threat. Not physical threat, by the way. I don't need a report going in, but just threats and perhaps a bit of bribery. Do you know what? After it being tidied, it will soon get into a mess. And then before she knows it, without even thinking about it, it just gets messier and messier. And of course, this can happen in our life. You know, we find ourselves in a mess, whether that's due to our own bad sort of decisions or actions, whether we've been dragged into this mess by someone else, or whether just through a series of unfortunate circumstances, we found ourselves in a mess. And whatever has caused it, we are in a mess. And sometimes, quite often, this mess can be made worse in our response to the mess. And we create an even bigger mess in our response to our mess. And so whether that's a financial mess that you make messier, whether it's a marriage mess you make messier, whether it is a relationship, a friendship mess messier, a professional mess messier, an academic mess messier, the list kind of goes on, we can find this pattern happening. We find ourselves in a mess and we make it messier. And here's the reason why we often make messes messier. It's because every mess you kind of find yourself in will always come with a set of bad options. They'll always come with some bad options. I'll borrow more. I'll just lie again. I'll lie about that. This is a bad one, particularly at work. I'll just send that email to try and fix what I thought I might need to fix, and then you end up making it worse. You send that text or that WhatsApp, and everything blows up in your face. I'll deny it. I'll stick my head in the sand. I'll pretend it doesn't happen. I'll pretend more around other people. You know, these bad options will always make the mess messier. Or as I like to spell it, messier. Now, I realize that's not how you really spell it. No need to send in any emails to Steve or anything about the spelling and grammar of the speakers. But it's messier. And I want to think about the because it's the is what happens when we respond to the mess in the wrong way. It gets messier. You see, when you're in the middle of a mess, you can't go and unmess the mess. But you can make it messier. You know, I like to be vulnerable when I'm speaking. And when I was a kid, and I'm feeling particularly vulnerable because I don't know if my mum knows this story, and she's sitting here this morning. It's not that bad, I promise. So I was probably, 11, 12, something like that, and I was playing around my mate's house with another mate, and we were playing football, and we decided to play football at the front of the house for some reason, I don't know why, and we had a little goal there, and we were playing football, and one of my mates, he kicked the ball, completely missed the goal, and went straight through the front window of his parents' house. Now, there was a moment where we just froze. What on earth do we do? We didn't communicate with one another, but it was almost like we just sensed what the right thing to do was in that situation. And of course, that was to pick up the goal, take it to the back garden where we normally play football, come back round, tidy it all up. We looked at the window and we saw almost, I've never seen this, but like a cartoon-esque round hole right the way through this front window. And so we obviously did the right thing, and we just, made it less football-shaped, and just smashed it a little bit, made sure that we hadn't stamped on any of the flowers, and we obviously did the right thing, and we ran. because Paul's parents weren't in, so we went round Simon's house, who lived just down the road, and then we came back a couple of hours later when we saw that Paul's parents had arrived home, and we walked through the door, and we'd been practicing our, like the story, what's the story, what are we going to say, best innocent face, you know, as we're walking, oh, hi, and Paul's dad was there, and he said, do you know what's happened? And we're like, what? What's happened? What? The front window has been smashed. And we were like, front window? Like, almost like replying like we didn't even know what a front window was. It's like, front window? Do you know what he's talking about? Are you sure you don't know anything about it? No. We've been around Simon's house all afternoon. Yeah. So he said, oh, look, come into the front room. And so we stood in the front room, and yes, the front window had been smashed. So we did our best shocked faces at that point. And Paul's dad was like, seriously, do you know what's happened? And we were like, no. And he said, well, can you explain why Paul's football is sitting on the drawing board, having knocked over a bunch of other ornaments, just nestled there? And of course, the colour must have drained out of our face. And we, in that moment, had made the mess messier. And I admit today that I may have made that mess even messier because I don't think my mum knew that story. So, let's see. But in life's messes, whether it's a financial mess, a relational, academic, professional, whatever it might be, health-wise, there are always some really bad options that come with that mess. Options, actually, that we could be expected to take, almost justified to take, perhaps entitled to take, that also seem to provide an easy, immediate, or satisfying solution to the mess that you're in, but that in reality simply just make the mess messier. And so today, as I said, I just want to bring a simple idea with a simple question that can help us avoid choosing these bad options when we're in the mess, that actually we avoid choosing those bad options that make the mess messier. And to do that, I want to share with you a story of a character in the Old Testament part of the Bible, and whether this is your first week of being in a church setting or if you've been here all your life, you will have heard about this character, I can guarantee it. And it's the story of a guy called David. And David eventually became the king of Israel, but his story starts when he was a little boy. This prophet called Samuel turns up at David's house and tells David's dad that your son has been anointed by God to be king. Now, that sounds amazing, doesn't it? But the issue is that there is already a king of Israel, and his name is Saul. And David is just this shepherd boy. He's not like in the line of succession, so he's quite a far way from being king. And as you may know, this lad called David, he ends up on the front line of a war, and he defeats a giant called Goliath. Hopefully some light bulb moments have gone off there, as in David and Goliath. David defeats Goliath totally unexpectedly. And suddenly, overnight, he becomes this kind of rock star. You know, if it was in these days, he would be all over Instagram and TikTok and all those sorts of things. And actually, as he gets older, he starts to lead more and more battles, and he's more and more successful. And people love him. They start singing songs about him. He becomes this kind of hero to people. And Saul, the actual king, well, he should be the hero. He should be the leader and taking all the credit for the winning all of these battles. Well, but he's not. David is. So he becomes afraid, or really jealous. As Samuel wrote in the book, when Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. When he saw how successful David was, he was afraid of him. And Saul couldn't cope with this. And he devised various plans to control David, actually even kind of indirectly kill him by sending him on increasingly more difficult challenges in battles that David should never have won, but always kept coming back winning. He tried to persuade David to marry his first daughter. That didn't work. And then so he tried to persuade him to marry his second daughter. Fortunately, David fancied his second daughter, so he got married. But the problem was that they loved each other. So Saul couldn't then control David. And this kind of fear grew as Samuel goes on in the next a few verses on. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him. And David remained his enemy for the rest of his days. You know, Saul is obsessed with this threat from David. And one afternoon in the palace, he just completely loses it. This is Saul. He completely loses it, and he tries to spear David with a javelin to kill him. And David obviously runs for his life, and a few other things happen. But what you need to know is that David ran for his life. He fled Saul, and he fled to the desert. And Saul made it his like number one aim to hunt down David and kill him. Now, here's the connection with all of this story and our address the mess series. You see, the reality is that David has a big mess on his hands. I think we can agree. And here's something that may be true for you in your life, and perhaps a mess that you find yourself in, is that David is in a big, messy situation, and it's not even his fault. He didn't ask to be king. He didn't ask, you know, he was just serving his country when he defeated Goliath, and he was just doing what was right and doing his best when he was defeating all of these, winning all of these battles. And no matter what he does, things just seem to be getting worse and worse. The mess just keeps getting worse and worse. And so David finds himself out in somewhere called the Engedi Desert. This is the Engedi Desert, a picture of it. As you can see, it's a pretty barren wilderness, a few rocks, a few caves, a few shrubs, and a spring or two. It's a pretty barren sort of place. And David finds himself here in this wilderness with a bunch of other people that had also fled Saul, and they're kind of like outlaws, if you like. You know, they were hiding from Saul because he was also trying to kill them. And this is where it gets tasty. The Bible is brilliant. If you've not read any of the stories in the Old Testament, they are amazing. So it gets a bit tasty here because Saul is obsessed with killing David. And he hears about a sighting of David out here in the Engedi. And so Samuel goes on. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all of Israel and set out to look for David. He really, really, really wanted to find and kill David. He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. Now let's pause here because I want to give some deep theological insight to something you may not have picked up on through this verse. So Saul is out hunting for David. David has heard about Saul being close, and so he's hidden in a cave. The exact cave that Saul chooses to go and relieve himself, i.e. have a wee. Now, I realize that you didn't realize it was going to be that deep this morning, but that's what he was doing, just in case you didn't know. So David is in this cave with his closest men that are all kind of got this common enemy, and this biggest enemy is the person who's trying to kill him is right here in front of them in a very vulnerable position. In a very, very vulnerable position. And none of his army are in the cave to protect him. Now, surely this is a situation that God has delivered for David. It's got to be, hasn't it? You know, all David has done in his life is step up time and time again to do the right thing. And yet he finds himself in this mess. His marriage is kind of non-existent because he's had to run away from his wife, who is also the person who's trying to kill him, their daughter. His destiny or anointing to be king is completely distant, and it's all this guy's fault. It's all Saul's fault. Surely God has delivered this situation for David to take his revenge, claim his destiny. That would be the drama, wouldn't it? Saul was the problem, and God had just delivered the solution. It couldn't be more clearer, could it? You know, there was even this expectation for David from his men to act. You know, they thought this had been the moment they'd all been waiting for. They go on and say this. It says, the men said, this David, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. And David, in this moment, surely he could feel justified. He could feel even entitled to take this opportunity with his enemy in this most vulnerable of positions. And you know what? Perhaps we feel this in our situations where we've been hurt and we feel entitled to or justified to take certain actions. And so David creeps up on Saul. And right there, I'm just going to pause the story. I know, cliffhanger. I should have had the duff, duff, duff. You see, David had options in front of him, some really obvious options that I'm sure you're all thinking about. But as we said earlier, quite often when you're in a mess, the options in front of you are generally some bad options, ones that can make the situation worse. I mentioned about earlier about giving you a simple idea or a question that can help us avoid making messy situations messier. And I like to think that this is the exact question that Saul was asking himself, David was asking himself right at this very moment as he's creeping up on to Saul. And the question is this: what story do I really want to tell? You see, the story when you're in a mess is not so much the mess, but your response to the mess. You know, when you're the other side of the mess, when you're looking back on it, what is the story that you really, honestly want to tell? And perhaps David thought to himself in that moment, do I really want the story to be this? Well, you know, I became king, sneaking up on the real king in a cave while he was having a wee and murdered him. Yeah, because that shows like real, you know, authenticity and integrity, doesn't it? It's a bit embarrassing. Could you imagine telling the grandkids, oh, granddad, tell us again when you became king. It's quite embarrassing. Now, there's a word that we don't really use that often in daily life in 2024. But actually, the absence of this word and the things that it means and it represents in our lives will actually, the absence of it will often lead us into messy situations and also making bad decisions off of being in a mess. And the word is this. It's virtue. Now, virtue is defined as this. It's behavior showing high moral standards, or it's a quality of doing what is right, avoiding what is wrong. So virtue is integrity. It's honesty. It's patience. It's self-control. It's goodness. And every mess that we are faced with comes with these bad options. And those bad options will often always involve a lack of virtue. I think I'm going to make this better. I'll fix it. I know what I'll do. I'll borrow more money. I'll just lie again. I'll cover it up. I'll get revenge. All lack of virtue. And a lack of virtue equally can create a mess, but it doesn't actually make a mess. It doesn't fix a mess. It just makes the mess messier. So let's get back to David. So David is creeping up behind Saul and it dawns on him. Perhaps he's asked himself this question. Hold on, I'm about to make my mess messier. Perhaps he asked himself the question again. What story do I really want to tell? I'm going to murder the king? My king? God's king, actually, at that point. He's my father-in-law. That makes him my wife's dad, my kid's granddad. Do I really want that to be my story? And David in that moment wanted to tell a story of virtue, of doing what was right. If he did kill Saul in that moment, it would be expected. It would be justified, yes. But would it be virtuous? Would it be the right thing to do? Would it be of integrity and honesty and self-control? No, it wouldn't. So David's response was this. Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He chose in that moment a different story. He doesn't kill Saul, but cuts off the corner of his robe. He even stopped his men from killing Saul. Remember, they wanted to kill him just as much as David had done. And Saul eventually went on his way, after he'd finished, went on his way, exited the cave. And then, this is where it gets even better. David appears at the entrance of the cave, going, "Woo, Saul!" Remember, there's 3,000 men hunting David, and he's appeared at the mouth of the cave. And he says this day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in that cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. May the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. David's response is this. You've wronged me, but I'm not going to wrong you back because that's not the story I want to tell. You've hurt me, but I'm not going to hurt you back because that is not the story that I want to tell. He opted for virtue. That was the story he wanted to tell. And you know what? In the end, at the end of Saul's story, seven chapters later, Saul is killed by a random arrow in battle. And David becomes king of Israel, not through his own hand taking revenge or doing anything like that, but by not allowing that to be his story. And David's story is not one in that moment of killing Saul to become king. He chose virtue. Now, what does that mean for us today? You know, the reality is if you found yourself in a mess, or you're in a mess, or you're about to be in a mess at some point in the future, that mess will eventually get reduced down to a sentence or two. I went through a divorce. I was fired for misconduct. I was made redundant. I found my partner having an affair. I dropped out of university. I don't see my kids anymore. I built up a massive debt. I've been in addiction to XYZ. Eventually, your story will be reduced down to just a phrase or a sentence or two. And the mess is the mess. Once you're in it, you can't unmess it. It's there. The real story is your response to the mess. If you respond to the mess with any of the bad options, you will always make the mess messier. You might feel better for a bit. It might give you satisfaction, but it won't last. It won't last. The only way to feel free to do what's right, it leads us back to this key question. What story do I really want to tell? What honest story do I really want to tell? When people hear you went through a divorce, what story do you want to tell coming out of that? When people hear you're in addiction, what story do you want to tell coming out of that? Perhaps you dropped out of uni or broke up in a relationship or lost your job, but the question is, what's the story? What did you do as a result? You got caught, you got hurt, but what was your response? Because your response to the mess is what becomes the story. And don't choose an option that forces you, that means that you're going to lie for the rest of your life, or that you become a hypocrite. And don't use someone else's bad behavior as an excuse for your own bad behavior. How can you respond with virtue, with honesty, with integrity, with patience, with self-control, with love? It's hard. It's not easy when you're in that situation. And that's why. How do we do that, Mike? You don't know my situation, Mike. How do I do that? And through this series, we've heard some really powerful talks through this topic of the mess in our lives. And particularly Martin in week two. And if you've missed week two, I recommend you catch up on all of them online at forgechurch.com. And if that's you today catching up online, welcome. But Martin in week two spoke about this concept of how Jesus meets us in our mess. He meets us in our mess. And he doesn't condemn you. There's stories in the Bible of Jesus' life how he didn't condemn others. He met them where they were at. He sees your mess as an opportunity to invite him in, but he also sees it as an opportunity for himself. He asks you to do something. And it's this. Jesus says, "Follow me." Jesus won't fix the mess, but he invites us all to follow him. He says, "Follow me and I will lead you out of this mess. I can't fix the mess, but I'll lead you out of it. And if you follow me through your mess, we'll walk past a bunch of options. Options that you may be expected, entitled to take. Options that your friends would say, go and do that, send that text, get him back. And Jesus will say, follow me. Remember virtue. Remember love. Remember patience. Remember self-control. And we'll walk past a bunch of options. And one day when you talk about your mess and you sum that up in two sentences, when you talk about your response, if you follow Jesus, you won't have to lie. You won't have to be a hypocrite. You won't have to use someone else's bad behavior as an excuse for your own bad behavior. Jesus says, just follow me. Follow me and your mess will become your message. My message in your life. The message of your life. That's what Jesus does. He redeems bad things. He doesn't condemn. He redeems bad things. He makes beautiful things out of ugly situations. The mess will just become simply the context of the real story. The story of your life in Jesus. Now, there'll be things running through your mind right now. Perhaps in the previous weeks, you've had things, yeah, I'm in this mess. I've been in this mess. I'm about to be in a mess. Don't let this moment pass. If there are people here today that are thinking, I don't know what to do. I don't know what this means to follow Jesus, but I'm here. I don't know what's brought me here, but I'm here. I've never done it before. This is your opportunity. Speak to someone. Pray with someone. You don't necessarily have to reveal everything that is your mess, but just accept that invitation for Jesus to follow, for you to follow him. Perhaps you've been in church all your life and you've made a decision before to follow Jesus, but let's face it, life gets in the way. And you found yourself in messes, and perhaps you're not proud of how you might have dealt with those messes because you tried to forge your own way. Perhaps today is a day where you can meet him here again in the mess and follow him. How will you respond to your mess? With David, God did not fail him in that moment. That was his story. He chose to do the right thing. Now, what you need to know about David, I'm not going to dwell on it for very long, but he messed up in the future and he made his messes messier. And that's something that we can do. So we need to keep focused on our eyes on Jesus. So for you in your mess, if you will embrace virtue, if you will show integrity and patience and self-control, if you will ask yourself the question, what is the story that I really want to tell? And if you choose to follow Jesus through that mess, well, that is the way to address the mess. Can I ask you to stand? I'm going to pray and the band are going to lead us in a final song. Heavenly Father, I really get a sense through this series, people have been challenged. People have hopefully understood a little bit about what it looks like to follow you, that you're not necessarily going to fix our messes and unmess the mess, but you'll lead us through that mess. That you work within us and there's an outpouring of love, of your love outside of us. And Lord, I just pray for those people that sit here today and they're thinking, I am in a mess and I don't know what to do, and perhaps I've taken a couple of options which have already made the mess a bit messier. And I pray, Lord, that they feel that sense of being able to meet you in that mess and that they accept your invitation to just follow me. Take that step and follow me. Amen.